This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, I'm trying to reach David Ortiz, please.
This is David Ortiz.
Hello, David. This is Jack O'Connell with the Baseball Writers Association of America. I'm calling you from Cooperstown, New York, to let you know that the Baseball Writers have elected you to the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes!
Mike, I say this a lot. There's nobody I'd rather talk to today than you. But I mean it more so today than most days, because who better to talk to about David Ortiz than the guy who literally wrote the book on him? So when you hear David Ortiz, first ballot Baseball Hall of Famer, you think what?
I think I'm really happy for him. I was so proud of him. I knew it was inevitable. I didn't know it was going to happen on the first ballot. I thought it would be close because the MLB writers have had a hard time recently, like in the last 50 years, of putting a designated hitter in the Hall of Fame first, not to mention the PED story that came out in 2009 based on the 2003 test that was not official. But there are just two designated hitters in the Hall of Fame. Ortiz becomes the second after Edgar Martinez in 2019. But just thinking about the guy and his journey, and it really couldn't go to a better guy. I'm just really excited for him, knowing where he came from in the Dominican Republic, knowing the twists and turns on his way to the Hall of Fame. It's pretty incredible when you think about some of the others. Some of the others who are there, some who should be there, and I know we'll talk about that later. Some of these guys we're talking about were, you know, top five, top 10 picks, sons of major league players, or been identified at a long time at a young age. Hey, this guy's
going to
get there.
Kind of born and bred to do it.
Yeah. But that really wasn't his story. You know, Mike, a lot of people don't know David Ortiz, when he was 14, 15, 16, he thought he was going to play in the NBA. He loved the NBA, watched the NBA in the Dominican Republic, loved Charles Barkley, loved Karl Malone. He was a big kid, 6'3", 6'4", not as hefty as he was when he played, but he could ball. You know, a left-handed baller. And he thought, hey, I'm going to play in the NBA. He was on a traveling team in the Dominican Republic. They used to go all over the island, and he was a pretty good player. And when he thought he was going to get a major league invite when he was 16 and a half, 17, he thought he was going to be signed by a major league team. They looked at him. He had a bad week or bad couple weeks of practice, and he didn't get the invite that he thought he was going to get. And that team cut him. It was Florida. Yeah. Florida cut him. And he went to talk to his dad. His dad said he was down, really depressed. David was. Dad said, okay, son, what happened? Did you break a leg? Did you break your arm? Is something physically wrong with you, son? David said, no. And then his father started laughing. He said, Dad, why are you laughing? I told you I got cut. He said, team just made the biggest mistake of their lives. You're going to make it. You're going to make it. It's just not there. The opportunity is coming somewhere else. So I'll tell you one more story that just makes me laugh and tells you about Ortiz, the personality. I mean, the talent is obvious, the power, the ability to be nerveless in the clutch. But he was always a leader among his teammates, whether his teammates were U.S. citizens or teammates from were from the Dominican Republic. So when he first time he left the Dominican, first time he was ever on a plane, he was 17, and he went to Arizona, played the rookie league. Noon temperatures, like around 100 something degrees. They're playing games in like 103, 104 degrees. He was like, it's hot. I took a little bit of English lessons because my father told me, you're going to need this one day. You're going to be a major league player. Really study your English. So he was one of the few players who could speak English among the Dominicans on the team. So they're in Arizona. They don't know what's going on. And he was able to lead them. He'd say, all right, this is what you need to do, whether it was, you know, going to the ballpark or understanding the American culture or joking around, because the man loves to joke around. So one of the things, I love this story, told me like one of his teammates went to a soda machine, like a vending machine, and wanted a soda. So the word in Spanish, the word dime, dime is slang for say it. So okay. His teammate is putting some coins into this machine.
Okay.
And Ortiz, and he didn't put in enough.
Okay.
So the thing said, dime, dime. You need another dime.
Dime. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So Ortiz is saying, hey, man, you got to scream at it for it to come out. So, the guy was saying, soda, Coca-Cola. He just kept screaming. And Ortiz is telling him, say it louder. It still says teammate, say it louder. So the guy's
cool. That's cool.
And they're all rolling as the guy is screaming. He's like, no, I'm just playing with you, man. Put a dime in and it'll come out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he's always been that guy. People have always followed him. All the way to the very end of his career in 2013, last thing I'll say, 2013, they're going to the World Series. They're down to the St. Louis Cardinals. They're trailing 2-1 in that series. Ortiz is hitting out of his mind. But everybody else around him, you know, he thought that they lacked confidence. And it's a famous picture. He called his teammates together in the dugout. And he said, look, are you guys scared? Are you scared? Are you scared of this guy? Are you scared of this team? No, we're not scared. You're playing like you're scared. Come on now. It's a World Series. This is the moment. This is what we've been talking about. Let's go. They come back. They win that game. They don't lose another game in the series. So he was a clutch player. He was a leader. He was a prankster. He would make everybody. He'd make so-called little people. He would make them feel important as soon as he walked into the room. He still does that. He was great. The Red Sox have an association with the Jimmy Fund, which is known for cancer research, especially with kids. Right. Ted Williams started it. David Ortiz, any kind of patient, he'd walk into the room, walk into a hospital. They all feel like they're important. So congratulations to David Ortiz for making it to the Hall of Fame.
Hey, I'm going to ask you that good old Boston Sports Talk Radio question. First time caller, long time listener, so you mentioned Ted Williams, man's got a tunnel named after him in Boston.
Yeah.
I don't know the last time you had this conversation. Ortiz, Mount Rushmore, Boston sports. Ortiz is definitely on it, right? Okay. All right.
He's got to be on it.
I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah. No, sorry, yeah. Thanks. Hey, thanks guys. Thanks. Enjoy the show. And you know, y'all need to know, family, y'all out there, you need to know Michael Smith, shame on him. I think the statute of limitations is up on this, so this story can be told. Michael Smith one time called sports radio with a Boston with his Boston accent and pretended to be
terrible,
like
Boston
Tony.
Accent.
Tony, no, it worked. It was like Tony from Framingham. He was living out in Framingham, Massachusetts at the time, suburb of Boston. Hey guys, hey, you know, love what you're doing. Love what you're doing out there. Hey, let me just throw
first
this
time,
out.
Long time.
And this went on. And this went on for like 12 minutes. I should have hung up on him, but I just let him go. I was like, how long is he going to keep this going? But he just kept going.
Yeah.
Anyway, I say character. Ortiz makes it because, you know, 04, 2007, 2013, those three championships, including the big one that broke a drought. And Ted Williams, look, Ted Williams, the numbers, Like, nobody's got numbers like Ted Williams. It's silly stuff. Silly stuff. You look at his on-base percentage, his slugging percentage, like all the stuff. And he missed time going to – he went to war and then came back from war. He was flying planes and then coming back and, you know, hitting hitting home runs. It's an incredible story. His story is great, but still championships. Yeah. So I give it to Ortiz.
Did more for the team. Yeah. I mean, listen.
Ortiz in championships, Ortiz in postseason.
That's three. I mean, if you want to put Williams and Ortiz, you want to get two Red Sox. I mean, it's like, okay, Brady, Belichick, Bobby Orr, Bill Russell. I mean, Mount Rushmore in Boston doesn't work. What if I can get personal, well, more personal, what is your relationship with him now? How long ago did you write that book again? How long did you write the book with
Came out in 2017, May of 2017.
Y'all still keep in regular touch? I didn't know if you had a chance. I'm sure his phone is blowing up since yesterday. I didn't know if you had a chance to text him or be in contact with him since last night.
Send a text, reach out to him, and vintage David Ortiz. So I sent a text yesterday. He'll get back to me in about a week and a half. So me, with punctuality? I told you before, David Ortiz is next level. But I will give him this, and I enjoyed this so much. And this is such a brother from another story. We can all relate to this. The end of it is a brother from another story. We got into a routine. He would say, come to my house and let's just talk. Let's just talk for as long as you need. He's like, how long do you think we should talk? I said, well, David, you played 20 years. So I'd say at least 20 hours, like an hour for each season of your career. And it was much more than that. But I wanted to set the tone there. I wanted to set a foundation just to get more time. I don't want it to be less. And so we would go. I'd go out to his house. And eventually, after he'd go through his own thing, got to be clean and all that stuff, we'd sit down and we would talk. But I could see him in his house, in his element, and how it worked. And it was great. Like, we'd go down to his basement, and he'd have all this memorabilia. We're sitting there talking, and I remember one day we're sitting there talking, and all of a sudden, boom, I heard this noise outside. Then I heard his wife, Tiffany, say, David, come here. I'm like, hold on, man. Go up. Hey, the umbrella flew from the outdoor table. The umbrella flew off. I need you to go out and pick it up. So it's like, all right. It was just like these everyday, these mundane tasks that we do all the time.
Still had to do
the great David Ortiz at the crib. At the crib, so what? So what? Hey, you know, there's some boxes that came. I need you to take those boxes upstairs or downstairs. It was just the ordinariness of Ortiz, who was seen outside of his house as this extraordinary figure, but his
larger
kids would do the same thing.
Yeah.
Hey, like, his kids would come by, friend from school. Oh, hey, Dad. and then just keep pushing. You know, and his kids went to public schools. That was intentional. Yeah. They really, you know, Tiffany and David, I know they're in the process of separating now, but they were really passionate about making sure that their kids were a part of whatever community that they lived in. And so that was the other part of Ortiz's story, that there is these contrasts of big moment, larger than life. But when he was at home, he really was at home. Didn't have somebody. There was no butler who come to the door. Hello, sir. I'll see you. And no, it was just like, hey, what's up, man? Let's go. You ready to talk? Let's talk.
He got to the Sox in 03. 02, 03, which year did he get to the Sox? 03, the reason I say that is I wish I had the pleasure of covering him. I wish I had the pleasure of being in the clubhouse around him. By that time, I had drifted away from the Red Sox. My exposure to the Red Sox was you know, Pedro at his peak, when him pitching at Fenway was literally an event, you know, on Yawkey Way and in Boston. By the time I got to, you know, 02, 03, Ron the Red Sox every now and then. So I may have bumped into him. And I'm sure he was friendly, if I recall correctly. I'm sure he was. But by that time, I was more focusing on the NFL. So I wish I'd had the pleasure. One of four players with 500 home runs and three World Series titles. Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, Reggie Jackson, David Ortiz. This is the only time, the first, last, and only time that I am going to agree with Curt Schilling, speaking of the Red Sox and the curse, who tweeted yesterday that every time the Hall of Fame induction comes around, we make it more about who didn't get in versus who did. So congratulations, David Ortiz. Your co-author just told some amazing stories. Your numbers, your accomplishments speak for themselves. But like everybody, his legacy is more complicated than just his accomplishments. So with that said, that segment was devoted to David Ortiz. We're going to take a break. We are not going to muddy the waters on a David Ortiz conversation with a conversation about those who were once again excluded. I wanted to hear you drop some knowledge on Ortiz since you know him as well as anybody possibly could that didn't play with him.
Yeah, and you know why they call him Poppy, right? You know the Poppy story.
What's the story?
He's like Biggie Smalls? With names. No, he doesn't remember people's names.
Oh, so he's calling everybody Poppy. So he called everybody Poppy.
Poppy. Yeah. Instead of like calling somebody, my man, buddy, like Poppy. Mm-hmm. Hey, what's up, Poppy? What's up, Poppy? So people started calling him Big Poppy. And the worst part of it, he is bad with names. The worst part of it is the guy who hit in front of him was called Petey. Dustin Pedroia.
Dustin Pedroia,
nicknamed
Petey. Yeah.
So he never knew Dustin Pedroia's first name was Dustin. So Pedroia gave him a hard time. He said, look, man, I'm introduced before you. They say Dustin Pedroia. What did you think my name was?
Poppy was too busy being fly.
Was Dustin?
Hey, it was hard work making it look that easy and that good. Poppy was too busy being fly. You know what I'm saying?
Always.
That's what it comes down
to. A lot of fun, though. A lot of fun, man. Like one of the most fun projects I've ever done. Thankfully.
That's awesome.
It was a blessing to do it.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
All right, so you need 75% of the Baseball Writers Association of America votes to get in. David Ortiz got 77.9%. He's the lone inductee this year, zero last year. Again, one of four players with 500 home runs and three World Series titles, has the most postseason go-ahead hits in history, I believe, with 17, if memory serves. But he was mentioned in the Mitchell Report, and he is connected to the steroid era. Which leads us to, once again, Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, along with Curt Schilling and Sammy Sosa, in their 10th time on the ballot, are now off the baseball writers' ballot. Their fate rests with the Veterans Committee, the Today's Game Era Committee. They can get 12 out of 16, 75% of that committee's votes. And they can still get in the Hall of Fame. They can still get into Cooperstown. You know, Michael, it's funny. I haven't had this conversation in a long time. Once upon a time, this was like an everyday conversation in sports talk, especially at the height of the steroids era and the fallout from the steroids era. And I feel like I evolved because, you know, I like to be consistent, but not stubbornly consistent. I think I evolved. I think early on, I may have been part of the outrage mob. I may have been part of the cheated the game chorus. I feel like I was at one point, but like many people, my attitude has softened and evolved about this. I was always conflicted. I at least know that at the minimum I was conflicted. It wasn't just, nope, you did PEDs, you're out. Because I always recognized that there were plenty of cheaters in Cooperstown, plenty of people who performed in a segregated game in Cooperstown whose careers deserve asterisks. Who are in Cooperstown. There are no perfect people in Cooperstown despite this morality or character clause, which is the problem with this process because you have flawed human beings judging other flawed human beings. And I'll ask you the question this way, Michael. What does a greater disservice or what discredits the Hall of Fame more? Letting people like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Curt Schilling, Sammy Sosa, Alex Rodriguez, hell, Pete Rose, as far as I'm concerned, let him in too. What's worse, letting them in or keeping them out? Because if for me, a museum is about telling a story. History.
Telling a story.
It's about telling a story.
Yes.
The story of baseball is incomplete, and we don't need it sanitized. We don't need it edited. Just tell the truth. No. It's not hard.
Tell a story.
But if you're going to keep the greatest baseball player that most of us have ever seen, who was already a Hall of Famer before he ever thought about taking performance-enhancing drugs, if you're going to keep the most dominant pitcher out that many of us have ever seen, with all due respect to some others who are in the conversation, then, like, let's just clean up the whole thing. You want to clean up the game? Let's clean up the game. Let's vacate their records. Let's vacate their awards. Let's vacate all the team accomplishments that their teams and teammates achieved, thanks in no small part to their contributions. Let's refund all the money that baseball and baseball owners made off of Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Barry Bonds. Let's take Bud Selig out of the Hall of Fame, as he oversaw the steroid era. Let's take off some wins from some of these managers, like a Tony La Russa. Let if you want to go there, let's go there.
Who's in the Hall of Fame?
But to keep, but to keep these people all out of the Hall of Fame, it doesn't hurt them, because we all know that they're Hall of Famers. We all know what they did. We saw it with our own eyes. It hurts the credibility of the baseball, right?
It hurts both.
And more so, well, no, I'm not talking about how they feel about it. I'm not talking about how they feel about it. I'm saying it doesn't hurt their reputations, because we know what they did. Their numbers and accomplishments and ability speaks for themselves. They may be disappointed, even though they won't necessarily admit it. What I'm saying is, it does more damage to the credibility of the Hall and the baseball writers, who after 10 years cannot see fit to get off their high horse, get off their soapbox, and take off the white wig and understand that these people are integral to the history of baseball and belong in the Hall of Fame, full stop.
What was the, I'll get there, because you just said a lot of beautiful things right there, really did. But you need to remind me, because you're better at the recall on this than I am. What was the Chris Rock joke? When he was like, who's more racist than old black people?
That was it. Old black men. Said, if the revolution ever come, I'll kill a first.
That's right. I love Susie.
Just to show him my main business.
None of this couldn't get a cab, so they were the cab.
Right.
You know what
they
I mean?
They were the cab. Left. Left.
Left.
Right.
The reason I bring that up is because we keep talking about the baseball writers. But some of these Hall of
Famers.
The
players, too. Oh, hi, Joe Morgan.
Some of these Hall of Famers.
No, it's the players, too.
I mean, they are more militant. They are more get off my lawn. The fortress is real with them.
Yeah.
They ain't trying to see these guys get in. And so when I look at taking it from the writers, and you mentioned the Today's Committee, the Today Committee is going to meet this year in the Baseball Hall of Fame to see if Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa have a more embraceable audience, a more forgiving audience. No, they don't. Not there.
Not with them.
So a lot of these. The problem is deep. The problem is there are a lot of pockets that are just not having it, or they just don't want to hear it. You can make these reasonable arguments about a museum or anything like that, but once they get into the club, then it's more exclusive. I'm in now. So I ain't trying to have this guy in, or I'm not trying to have him in. And all the things you say are absolutely true. I mean, it's hard to look at some of the inconsistencies in baseball and then take the whole operation seriously. All right, so really, there are guys in the Hall of Fame who never played against black players.
Yeah.
But black players were alive.
And who are a part of shutting out black players. There are
y'all don't have a problem
in the
with
Hall
that?
Of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, y'all don't have a problem with that?
There are cheaters in the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
There are people connected to PEDs David Ortiz even. I mean, it's like David Ortiz belongs in Hall of Fame. His connection to PEDs, while, you know, it may not be the same set of circumstances as somebody right. else, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He even said, how am I in and they're not?
Yeah. So really, okay, let's just talk about this. Your point of, all right, the steroid era. We call it the steroid era, capital S, capital E. It was a real thing. It wasn't 5 years, it wasn't 10 years. Way back in 1988, Thomas Boswell of the Washington Post wrote a column about Jose Canseco. And this was at Fenway Park. Yeah. Fenway Park, Oakland A's, Boston Red Sox. They're chanting steroids at Fenway.
Yeah.
I was like, look, that's 34 years ago. They're chanting steroids. So I would say the era unofficially started then, because Canseco was one of the few doing it in 88. By 90, 91, 92, especially 93,
everybody was doing it.
It started to turn. So let's say that era unofficially, 1988 to the first year of testing, 2004. That's a grip. That's a real era. And so I think if you're going to shut those guys out, you're making a mistake. Just call it the steroid era. Have a whole wing in the Hall of Fame. Steroid era, tell the story.
I don't even need to go that far. Because again, then let's start categorizing like we just talked about. All the people who, you know, look a little funnier in the light as time goes on. Do we need to say, okay, if you know, pre-integration, y'all over in this corner. Like, I don't think you need an asterisk.
Tell that story too.
Okay, but I don't think you need to like necessarily separate the players.
I'm not saying put a scarlet letter on them. I'm not saying that. What I'm just saying is, as we go through, like you've been to the African American Museum, and every stage, every floor, every exhibit, it represents a piece of history. And so you're telling that story. Okay, here he is. This is where we were with busing. And this is where we were with, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson and what that meant in the late 1800s. And you're telling the story of history, and you're telling the story of baseball. And I just think it's interesting that Bud Selig, who presided over this era, is in. How do you say that this era was so terrible and its stars need to be shunned when the commissioner of baseball, the only commissioner, by the way, in my lifetime, who canceled the World Series, he's in the Hall of Fame, but the stars of that era are not. You can't do that. It doesn't work.
I don't care what they put in their bodies. The amount of money they put in owners' pockets, in networks' pockets, is immeasurable.
Yeah.
Everybody enjoyed the show. Everybody enjoyed the show until we decided to grow conscious about it. And this is the thing that baffles me. Like, I'm gonna use some numbers that's just gonna make it silly for you. And not their statistics. Everybody knows the statistics, okay? Barry Bonds, they got the highest percentage of votes in 10 years. Barry Bonds got 260 votes. Roger Clemens got 257 votes, okay? They each needed 296. So that means because 40 people, versus 260 people, but 40 people were like, I'm not comfortable with the fact that they're not in Cooperstown? 40 people.
Right.
40 people. Like, come on. Like, it's just that this system is absolutely silly, and we're all adults. Put them in Cooperstown. It's easy to explain that their legacies are complicated, but they are conspicuous by their absence. From a place that is there to tell the history of baseball.
Michael Smith. Alex Rodriguez was a Hall of Fame shortstop. He was a Hall of Fame shortstop and a Hall of Fame third baseman. Because when he went to New York and played third base, sorry, Derek, it was your team. You're the captain. He had to step aside. But if you really wanted to be honest about it, Alex Rodriguez was your best shortstop. Who's playing third base? Yeah. So he's a third baseman. And now he starts his career as a Hall of Fame third baseman, ending it only because he got traded to New York. He ends it as a shortstop, but he was still going. And I know You want to talk about complicated. His complications are way up there. But that's not really what I want to say.
Yeah.
When you talk about an era, we always look at the top of it. We always look at the top. So I already mentioned the top man in charge, Bud Selig. I've talked about the top players of the steroid era, whether it's Roger Clemens or Barry Bonds. But how about this? When the top of the culture, when the top of the era, it's happening up there, that means there's a trickle-down effect. In other words,
right.
There were good players who became all-stars in the steroid era that we didn't pay attention
right.
to.
There were people who shouldn't have been in the majors.
There were AAA guys who were the 24th and 25th right. guy because of the right. steroid era. It affected
and
the
affected
entire
the
game.
Outcome
so you
of game.
Can't say, I'm glad. Well, I don't know about you.
You can't measure. Yeah,
you're clean. You're clean.
Real quick,
so
before
I'm gonna
we
put
go
you
to break.
You don't know that.
I'm glad you mentioned Alex Rodriguez. It may be as simple. Maybe as simple. This might not be a blanket statement. Maybe they just don't like Barry Bonds for a variety of reasons, which are well documented. Maybe they just don't like Roger Clemens. There's plenty of reasons not to like Curt Schilling. I can't argue with that one as much. You know, I mean, but Ortiz, very likable. Very likable.
Yeah.
So, it's not right. It's not right. It's because it's incomplete. And I don't want an incomplete story. I want the most comprehensive, unedited, unabridged story possible when I look at baseball.
I think it's going to happen. I think it will happen. It didn't happen yesterday, but I think we'll get there.
Even with that unforgiving audience of players and umpires, the general manager talked about, or whoever makes up this committee?
Yeah, they'll get there. They'll come around.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Michael, yesterday we were talking about Tom Brady and his potential retirement. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned Kobe Bryant and how, you know, the world and the sports world in particular just didn't feel right without Kobe Bryant front and center. Not realizing that today, not even thinking about the fact that today marks 2 years since Kobe, Gianna, and seven other passengers died in the tragic helicopter crash in California.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it got me to thinking about when I was reminded that today was 2 years, of course it feels like yesterday. We've continued talking about Kobe at different points. We talked about Vanessa Bryant's ongoing court battle with L.A. County sheriffs and their abhorrent behavior at the crash site and afterward.
Yeah.
It's like the thing about people like Kobe. Again, I told you, one of my biggest professional regrets is that I didn't make more of an effort to at least meet the cat, especially post-career. And you know, not saying that we would ever struck up any kind of relationship, but it would have been nice to talk to him when I had the chance. And as a matter of fact, I'll say this, and hopefully this doesn't sound weird, but there are times now when I kind of like, almost like imagine what a conversation would be like with Kobe right now. Sometimes just kind of like have little visions or whatever. I'm just like,
right.
What would Kobe say? What would I ask Kobe right now? What would I talk to Kobe right now? What if I had, you know, talked to Kobe those times when we kind of crossed paths or whatever? My son wears number 24. I don't know if I told you that. My son wears, you know, he plays basketball. He begged for 24. And so I often remind him of that if he needs another push.
Because of Kobe.
Right. He's not even, my son's 13, so he ain't even really old enough to truly appreciate what Kobe meant. But Kobe's his wallpaper on his phone. And I remember having to, like, console him on this day 2 years ago. We had to console each other. But so speaking of consolation, I guess the point I wanted to make was, even though today is 2 years, it's what's interesting about somebody who in life was as ubiquitous as Kobe. You know, when you lose somebody close to you, a parent, a significant other, a best friend, God forbid, a child, a grandparent. It's like you don't think of it. The grieving process doesn't take a year off until a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Right.
It's like maybe more people kind of stop and acknowledge that the round number that is 2 years since we lost Kobe Bryant. But the truth of the matter is for Vanessa and Natalia and Capri and Bianca, And us, even though, again, I didn't know Kobe, Kobe felt like family. Kobe felt like a brother from another, even though I never had the pleasure. And so it's like, I think about Kobe all the time. You know what I mean? It's like, randomly, just I'll think about Kobe Bryant. I'll think about what happened. And I'm sure every day is just like the day that they lost Kobe. Maybe less and less, I pray, you know, that peace that transcends understanding. I pray that every day is less and less painful somehow for Vanessa and the kids. But I'm sure, like, they're not looking at it like, oh, it's been 2 years, guys. It's like, yeah, they knew that yesterday and the day before and the day before and every day since that awful day. So it was just, yeah, it's interesting. Like, you know, it still doesn't feel real. Still doesn't feel real, even 2 years later.
Yeah, hey. But, you know, first of all, I want to tell you that that's not weird. What you said about, you know, sometimes you imagine conversations, you know, what conversations would be like with Kobe and what Kobe would be saying about the space that we're in right now. I know we're going to be out in L.A. in a little bit for the Super Bowl. And one of my favorite moments from Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly was that segment where he has this conversation, this imagined conversation he has with Tupac. You know, obviously never met him, but like, hey, I'm going through this. You went through this. What is that like? I think that happens a lot with people. When you have a loss, when there's an absence, you wonder, especially from somebody that you're close to or somebody that you have a lot of respect for, you wonder, okay, I'm experiencing this. Did you experience this too? Or I'm thinking way. I'd like to hear your thought about it.
It's more like when I was I'm talking specific, like you ever like replay scenarios? I'm talking specifically like when I was a young reporter in Boston and the Lakers were in Boston at the Garden and I imagined doing that again. Or like I was at the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture and Kobe was like right over there. And I didn't just want to run up on dude like that. You know, enough people were doing that. I didn't want to run up on him. I'm like, what if I had? Like, what would that conversation have gone like? What could have happened after that? You know what I mean? That was that
but
kind
I think,
of stuff.
I think I just, that's
like a missed opportunity.
I think that's good to think of for many reasons. And one of them is something we say it all the time, especially when there's a tragedy. And I can't speak for anybody else. I don't always follow up on that perspective that we say that we've learned. Okay, now you've got to appreciate this. You got to appreciate this moment. You got to appreciate this person or this blessing, whatever it is. We do it in tragedies, but I think, you know, great talents like Kobe and others remind us that there are a lot of these jewels that are just out there. Just like every day. I told you this before. I didn't say it on air, but we talked about this off air. You know, sometimes in the morning, I always... I drop off my kids in the morning. I'm a morning person. Which my wife is like, oh my God, how are you so on in the morning? Please. It's not brother from another. You know you're not on the air. Inside voice, please. But I'm just like ready to go in the morning. But I'll drop off my kids at two different schools. And sometimes with the oldest, I'll drop him off. He can't get out of the car fast enough, especially when his friends are walking by. He's like, okay. Okay. And you know, slow down here.
Hey, it's like, I don't want to stop your momentum, but like into the Spider-Verse, where the dad dropping off Miles, he'd be like, hey.
I love you. Copy. I love you. All right. I love you. I love you, Dad. I love you. But I'll watch it. Like, he'll go, and his friends are there, and I'll see him talking. And I'll just pause there for a second just to see him walking through. Because he's 13 and, this thing goes fast. It goes fast. And who knows? And probably
the days are long, but the years are
month,
short.
A month and a half, he might say, you know what? You don't need to drop me off. As a matter of fact, I'll get to school. I'm going to take the train. I'm going to take the bus with my boys, whatever it is. Yeah. And I think the same thing applies to Kobe. Now, you mentioned, you know, being at the Boston Globe and seeing him. And, you know, why didn't I follow up in that situation? Think about it, Mike. I saw him as a rookie. I saw his first game at Boston Garden. I'm watching Kobe Bryant, and it's Kobe is there, and Shaq is there, and I'm just like, hey, I'm an NBA beat writer. Okay, basket. number eight at the time. Okay. And then there are many other games, whether it was at the Forum and then the Staples Center, whether it was at the Garden over the course of his career. I remember a moment with Kobe and Kevin Garnett, you know, together in 2000, yeah. You know, 13, 14, somewhere around there, where Garnett has an award, has a milestone, one of his many milestones. Kobe looks at him. They're at the free throw line, just kind of waiting for a rebound, and Kobe gives him a nudge. They tell each other a joke, and it's probably like, hey, man, we've been here since we graduated from high school. Both of us came into the league at 18 years old, 18, yeah. 19. Imagine. So, but all of those moments, my point is, I saw this stuff up close, and I didn't yeah. appreciate it as much as I should have. And
oh,
I would
dude.
Say, we really have to do this. There are so many things that are happening for us athletically, socially.
Culturally. Yeah.
Like everything.
Yeah.
Just appreciate it.
And even toward the back half of his career, it was very polarizing. His style of play, his approach. You know, I didn't agree with a lot of things. I was critical of him at different times. I don't apologize being critical. It comes with the territory. But
right.
I will say that last game, top five moments for me
yeah.
as a fan. I have never been more of a fan
coming,
than
right?
I was that night. I was on TV that day and I said, he's going for 50 tonight. I didn't see 60 coming. I was like, he's going for 50
yeah,
tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was one of the top five moments I've ever had as a fan, watching that game from a hotel room on television. Still gives me chills thinking about how he went out. It still makes me sick to my stomach thinking about how he left us, how he and Gianna and those seven other passengers left us. But they're still here. They're still here. I got that picture still on my phone. That's my favorite picture. I got that one on my phone. And like I said, man, my son's wearing 24 and he's wearing it proudly.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
They make it three, I'm going to cry, bro. There's no way, bro. There's no way. Ain't no way.
Bro, teams were 1-16,239 over the last 20 seasons when trailing by 7 or more points with 20 seconds left. And the 2014 Cavs went in overtime to get that win. Luke Kennard scored 7 points in 9 seconds, leading to the bro, bro, bro. That was the second largest rally, down by 35. Second largest rally in a play-by-play era behind the 96 Jazz, who were down by 36. The Clippers are the first team over the last 25 years to have 3 comeback wins in a single season when trailing by at least 24. And they've done it 3 times in the last 14 days. Nuggets, Sixers, and Wizards. Kurt Hill from Pro Basketball Talk is here to help us react to something that we rarely have ever seen. Unprecedented type stuff. But you know what's interesting to me, Kurt? Is with no Kawhi, no Paul George, the Clippers aren't being conversed about in the context of being contenders. And therefore, we're not talking about the usual, can we trust the Clippers? Do you believe in the Clippers?
Right.
I feel like we should just sit back and appreciate the job that Ty Lue is doing with this undermanned roster.
Thank you. I'm glad somebody's talking about this. Like, he's not going to win Coach of the Year, right? Like, that's going to go to Billy Donovan or so, you know, somebody near the top of the list with these surprise teams, you know, Bickerstaff, somebody. Lou has done an insane job. Those guys are ready to play every night. They come out and they're just gritty. They're tough. They're hard to play against. They remind me of the pre-Kawhi Clippers in a sense, because that was another team. Yeah, that team had Lou Williams, a little flash, but they were just hard to play against. This team finds a way to just not stop grinding night after night. And, you know, hey, when you got Luke Kennard to close games, what else do you need? You don't need Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, right. Hey, Kurt, like, what do you think it is, though? What do you think it is, man? Like, we can talk about the grinding Clippers and how Ty Lue has coached them well. But when you blow a 35-point lead, are you giving more credit to the Clippers? Or do you say, what happened, Washington? Did you stop playing? Or you just, you're not that good? You're front runners? Like, how do you assess a 35-point collapse?
Yeah, I love it. David Aldridge, who we all know, called it the worst game he's seen from a team in 40 years of covering them. Which, if you've covered the Wizards for 40 years, like, there's some bad games in there, man. There's some there's some rough patches. To me, this is a struggling team right now that's really – I mean, they were so hot to early in the year, and we kind of thought they were, hey, man, this is a good story. And they've just come apart at the seams. You know, every team got hit with COVID. Every team got hit with injuries. But they have not had the depth. They have not bounced back. They've had stretches where, hey, Kyle Kuzma carried them for a little while, was hot. But it's just not – it has not been as cohesive. It has not stuck together, kind of like I think – I thought it would. I thought this team would be better than this. And – last night they just seem to turn off the engine somewhere, right? Like, they just, hey, we can coast this thing in. And you can't, I mean, not only can you not do that against the Clippers, you really can't do that against a lot of NBA teams. These are still guys with pride, right? You can't just mail it in the way they did in the second half. And bro, what are you gonna do? Like, I don't know what else to say.
Bro,
that was a horrible.
Bro.
So, right, so which bro. Brings us to oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, what happens to Bradley Beal?
Well, that's where I was going. Because one day you see a report that he's not going to sign. And then the next day, I think he did the Woj podcast saying, I want to build a legacy here. I want to do it differently.
Yeah. He's not going to sign the extension in the short term because there's 62 million reasons for him to get to the end of the season, get into his last year, and then either re-sign or extend off of that. Like, it's just financially – he in the past has made, he, you know, what one of the things he said before is that he's going to be selfish. In the past, he has, hey, I'm going to sign this and I'm going to leave you guys some space and we're going to make this easier on you. Not this time. He's going to take every dollar he can get. I think he, maybe unlike James Harden or others, he's going to look at this and say, I want every dollar here. And he's going to do what a lot of agents tell players to do. Grab the bag now. Grab every dollar you can. And if you want out in 2 years, we can make that happen. Like, it's easier to push your way out later. Just get the money now as opposed to giving up a little to get out.
You know, Kurt, I'm going to tell you what. I do not envy MVP voters this year. Let's take out Giannis for now and just focus on the bigs, the fives. Let's focus on Nikola Jokic. 28 points, 21 rebounds, and 9 assists last night. Joel Embiid, 42 points, 14 rebounds, 4 blocks, and 4 assists in 33 minutes last night. I think I saw this stat where Embiid is averaging more points in 2022, calendar year, than minutes. Like, he's just he's out of this world. There we go. Right on cue.
Wow. Right there.
I think MVP oftentimes is about narrative as much as it is about numbers. There's a lot of emphasis placed on where your team finishes in the standings. No team relies on a single player. With all due respect to LeBron, nobody relies on a single player more than the Nuggets do Nikola Jokic. If I had to pin you down right now, and thankfully you don't have to do it today, but after what you saw last night, these two go to work. Another night in the office for these two. Who would you say is your MVP right now? Or maybe it's Giannis. Maybe I don't want to disregard him.
Yeah, by the way, he is a five. He's playing a lot of five this year with Brook Lopez out. Yeah. But 2 weeks ago when we did this, I said, you know, I really dove into the numbers and we did a midseason thing for NBA, you know, NBA, NBC Sports. And I chose Giannis over Jokic just kind of barely. I don't know if I'd go back on that now. The bottom of that just changed because Kevin Durant's going to – he's falling out, and he will fall out after missing all these games. He'll kind of fall out of that top five, and Embiid climbing up. By the way, Luka Doncic has played really well of late too. Like, I don't know if he's going to climb all the way back in, but he's looked better. It would be a coin toss. Funny thing is, I'm one of those voters. I have one of those votes. MVP is usually not the thing that keeps you up. Like, usually that's maybe you're kind of debate the fourth or fifth spot down on that roster in your head, and you try to make that right. But usually by the end of the season, I'm pretty confident in who I'm going with for number one. If I had to choose between Jokic and Antetokounmpo right now with Embiid surging like this, I don't really know where I'd go. Curry's slumping off, but he's had this great. I lose enough sleep over third team All NBA. I don't know what I do when MVP vote comes up like this, man.
Well, because Embiid made it easy last year. Unfortunately, he got so much time. Jokic was brilliant and deserved it, but it was like if you were torn, he got hurt. If these two stay healthy and keep doing this, good luck.
Yeah, I don't know where I'm going to go. Embiid has been – it's just – part of MVP for me is the value to your team, right? How are you lifting your team up? How much is the team better because of you? Obviously, Jokic brings a lot of that. But Embiid right now on a Ben Simmons-less – we're not just missing a player, man. We're not filling him in with role players. Like, there's just nobody there. And he's lifting them up to – in the mix in the East, he's at another level right now.
Michael, you and I had this conversation. We had this conversation a couple of days ago. I would still go with Jokic. I think I said at that moment, and I still feel this way, that given the numbers, and Embiid's numbers are incredible, but Jokic's both counting and advanced stats are ridiculous. Given the numbers, I thought it would be idiotic, and I still do, to not give it to Nikola Jokic as he's on this record-setting pace and given how much he is meant to keep the Nuggets just afloat. I would vote for Nikola Jokic, Michael, if I had a vote, but I would feel real guilty. But I would feel guilty. I feel guilty about not giving Joel Embiid the award this year, but I'd probably give it to Jokic if I had to do one. What about you, Mike?
Kurt mentioned, Ben Simmons. And I was going to go there because right now I'd say Embiid is making a case. Embiid is making a really strong case. I go back and forth. And then don't forget the other five, the other five, the new guy, LeBron James. He's a five. he played five for a while and he was great. He was great as a five man, averaging about 34 points. So, but Kurt, you mentioned Ben Simmons and you ever around some people, or maybe you're one of those people. Sometimes you just smoke the right kind of stuff and you think you're saying something really deep and something so brilliant and somebody needs to give you an elbow and be like, man, shut up. Like, nobody, like, what are you talking about? I feel like Daryl Morey was on that the other day on the radio, though, talking about, hey, we can bring him back. I mean, like, why not? What is that about? And where do you think this guy is going? Where is Ben Simmons going? Where is this story going? I feel like at some point, this has got to come to a head, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what that stuff he's laced with there, because if he thinks Simmons is coming back this season, that's not just your average brownie or gummy, let's say. You've gone extra there, man, because that's not happening. Honestly, more and more, and I just thought that this wouldn't happen, some of my sources kind of thought it wouldn't happen, but now everybody seems to be coming around to it. The Sixers seem serious about, hey, if we're not getting what we want now, we will drag this out into next offseason and up to more likely the draft. I don't know that it'll get like all the way to July, but get to the draft when more picks are available and a lot of deals get done. And that's when it happens. I can't believe that it is a risk. We've been talking about how great Joel Embiid is playing. If you don't put enough pieces around him, can you get past the Bucks? Can you get past we haven't talked about the Miami Heat. Miami Heat are good, man. Are you going to get past these teams if you don't at least get something back for that? Are you wasting a year of Joel Embiid? They don't seem to think so. They're going to go forward and push this through into the next season. And if they do that, I have no idea where he goes. I've heard all the Harden rumors. I'll just say that that's a complex mess to make happen. That sign and trade would hard cap the 76ers. They'd still have to cut salary. It's a difficult move to make for Philly. So I don't know where he ends up. I just know that they're pretty serious about not just making a move to make a move right now.
All right, we're going to get you out of here with this one, man. Last night was incredible in the NBA. Tonight's got potential to be incredible. We got Suns, Jazz. Suns are the best team in the league. Jazz, something about maybe it's in the name. They continue to get slept on. Maybe they're too smooth. They'll be in there in the mix. We know that. Bucks will be there. The Cavaliers, Michael's favorite team. One of the best stories in the league. I guess I'll ask it to you this way, Kurt. How seriously should we take the Cavaliers? We try not to get too ahead of ourselves on this show, but it's hard not to respect them as more than just a cute story.
Yeah, I think they've reached the point of they're a problem in the playoffs. Again, I don't think they're knocking off, again, the Bucks or the Heat or whatever the Nets end up looking like at the end of the season. I don't think they're on that tier, but they've proven to me that they're legitimate. They've got something they can really build on here.
And maybe that's most
Evan
important.
Evan Mobley's a rookie. Mobley's a rookie in Garland
this year. You know?
Yeah, that's the thing. Get into the playoffs, right? Get in there, maybe win a round, but you kind of have to, especially young players, you still kind of have to learn how to win in the NBA, right? You still got to learn how to win in playoff basketball. And so I think that this is a huge postseason for them. And Kevin Love, sixth man of the year. I don't know if he's taking it from Tyler Hero or anyone else, but he's making a case.
Yeah, not crazy. Hey, man, we appreciate you, Kurt. Keep up the great work on NBCSports.com, Pro Basketball Talk.
Anytime, man.
Thanks for the knowledge, brother, and we will talk to you again soon. Be good.
Love talking to you guys. Take care, man.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, Kurt. You too.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Now the Chiefs have got to somehow get in field goal range.
Hey, 10. They might man you up. I'm saying go outside and come back in like you're running a route outside. Okay. That way when you come back in, I can get in the way.
They actually have a chance to get Bucker in field goal range here.
Hey. They're playing like that. That seam is open.
8 seconds left, down three.
I love that video so much. Isn't that
Don't you love that stuff? Don't you love it?
Well, because,
I love that stuff.
Because so many people, rightfully so, have focused on what the Bills didn't do in the last 13 seconds of regulation and how they didn't execute. Instead of the brilliance, the football IQ, the poise, and the execution that the Chiefs displayed in those last 13 seconds in making those two plays to get in the field goal range and sending it in overtime and have the walk-off win, which has led to continued conversation. I ain't letting it go. About overhauling the NFL's overtime rules. It's been on my mind.
Don't let it go.
It's the big story. I am going to single-handedly change this. And we've talked about it for the last 2 days. We've argued about it. We've agreed that both things can be true. That the Bills could have messed up in regulation. And it seems empty. It doesn't seem fair that Josh Allen did not get a shot in overtime. He had to watch the Chiefs march down the field against his number one ranked defense that couldn't stop the Chiefs and have a walk-off touchdown. It just doesn't seem fair. So we talked yesterday.
Number one in point differential, too. Number one in point differential in the league.
I think that's my thing. All right. I've been wanting to share this with you. The two things I wanted to get accomplished today. I wanted to talk about David Ortiz and hear from you as his author.
Okay.
Which was great. And I want to share with you an idea. There was an idea.
Ooh, ideas. Okay? Ideas.
There was an idea.
Ideas.
Okay. We said yesterday that perfect is the enemy of good. Michael, I think I have the perfect solution.
Perfect. It's a big sentence.
The perfect way to fix overtime. No, you don't have to write it down. It's right here. It's right here. No, I got a graphic for you. I got it here. It's right here.
All right. Okay, we got graphics.
It's called the all or nothing proposal. Okay? You ready? Untimed overtime period. Untimed.
Okay.
Equal number of possessions. So turnovers count as possessions. Now, here's where it gets fun. You cannot play for a tie or to extend the game, unless the team possessing the ball first converts a two-point conversion attempt, which means, let's play it out with Sunday night, okay? Mm-hmm. Chiefs go down the field, score a touchdown, kick an extra point. If the Bills get the ball and they march down the field and score a touchdown, they have to go for two. They can't kick an extra point and tie it again. And let me tell you the reason for this, that why this idea I think is great. If I may say so myself.
Okay.
What I didn't like about one possession each and then sudden death, that's still not fair. Because if you get each team one possession,
right,
and then the next team scores, where it's like, well, y'all got two times with the ball. How can we get two times with the ball? This way, it cuts down on the fear of the game going on forever. And it forces the team that has the ball second, which knows what it needs to do to outscore the team that had it first. Here's another scenario. Let's say the Chiefs get the ball and kick a field goal. The Bills have to score a touchdown. If the Chiefs get the ball and the Bills stop them, then the Bills only have to kick a field goal, which is the same as it is now. Okay?
Okay. All right, so let me tell you.
Lastly, the game, we're going to workshop this. Lastly, the game ends on a safety, defensive touchdown. The game ends on a safety, defensive touchdown, punt return touchdown, or kickoff return touchdown, provided the kicking team only kicked the field goal in the previous possession. In other words, if the opening kickoff of overtime is returned for a touchdown, game's not over. The other team still gets the ball. Okay? Where's the flaw? Show me the flaw. This is exciting. It would basically make everybody the Baltimore Ravens. Like, you got to go for the win. You can't kick a field goal and the game keeps going. You got to go for a touchdown.
Okay.
Well, tell me what's wrong with this.
It's just us talking. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about anybody else.
Okay.
This is between me and you.
Okay.
Were you smoking or eating?
Okay. We're being transparent.
Yeah, of course.
We're being transparent.
That's right. That's what we do.
If we're being honest, look, I wasn't smoking or eating anything. Michael, the old saying is good artists copy, great artists steal. Okay?
Who you steal this from?
In my 20 some odd years of doing this, I have never stolen from anybody. I will quote people, but every one of my thoughts is an original thought.
This might be serious.
It may not be a good thought. It may be dumb as hell, but it's my thought.
This just got real. Okay.
My other brother from another and my business partner, Terrence Williams, came up with this. And he told it to me last night, and I was like, dog, I love that idea. I love this idea. Tell me what's wrong with it. You asked me, was I smoking? What's wrong with it?
But you didn't answer. You said nothing.
I wasn't smoking. I was sober last night, and I slept on this, and I woke up this morning, and I still thought it was a good idea.
All right, you're trying to take out an inequity, and you've added one. So that's my first. Okay, that's my first. Yes, because you and Terrence, because
they have to go for
the
two.
Whole point. Yeah, and the other team doesn't. So the other team, you've introduced a harder play for the second team. Why? Hey, wait.
Here's why.
Why are you making me do something you didn't make them do? I'm going for two.
Here's why. Well, they all know you're going for two if you line up for two.
But I'm saying, I have to do that. You get a chance to prepare for it. It's not like the coach is not doing like this on the sideline or doing like that.
Otherwise.
You know what's coming.
Otherwise. When does it end? Okay? Otherwise, it doesn't end.
That's not
because,
my job.
The issue right now is you can't do alternating possessions just endlessly. Okay? Because, again, go back to the simplest one that's been proposed, which is each team gets a possession and then it goes to sudden death. That's been the simplest proposal. That doesn't work because if the third possession they score, well, what about ours? Why? How come we didn't get a third? Eventually, somebody has to say, we had our opportunities. The reason I like this is the first team on defense, just like now, you have an opportunity to make a stop. If you don't make that stop, now you get the ball. If you score, you can't just tie it and we do it all over again, because then there's a chance of we doing it over and over again. So if you're the team that's got to go for two, you have first failed to stop them from scoring a touchdown. But since you got the ball back, you have to one-up them. So the only penalty for losing the coin toss, right now the penalty for losing the coin toss is you may not get the ball. Michael, again, I got the stat wrong yesterday. The stat is, in overtime, in the playoffs, 11 times the team has won the opening coin toss. 10 times that team has won. Okay?
Yeah.
So the coin toss has too much weight. But if you don't get the ball first, okay, the penalty is you have to one-up them. Hold them to a field goal. And all you got to do is score a touchdown.
I'm telling you, I think that's a flaw. I'll tell you another flaw.
This is better than what we got. Perfect is the enemy of good. No, I think it's perfect, but this is better than what we got.
No, because then now we bring in the untimed period. Why we got an untimed period? That might end it. That might end it without all this like going back and forth. So exactly, I might be able to
If I've got
3 minutes left in overtime, we both have had a couple of possessions. So now, it's 2 minutes left in the game. We're going to the 2 minute warning. Game is tied. I'm at the 33.
This is regulation overtime. It's regulation overtime. Okay.
Overtime. It's 2 minutes left in overtime. You've had a possession. I've had a possession each time. So now, game's tied. 2 minutes left. I'm at your 33 yard line. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to chill right here.
That's why it's untimed. It's untimed.
No, I want to time it. No, because I can end it. I want a clock because I'm going to use the clock to my advantage, and I'm going to end this thing with the field goal.
That's what I'm telling you. But there's no clock. Get rid of the clock.
But I want a clock because untimed extends the thing.
This is my proposal. No, it does not.
I'm telling you, How many ties were there last year in the NFL?
How many ties?
Here's the reason.
How many ties were there in the NFL last year?
One. I'm not sure. Off the top of my
head. Yeah, Pittsburgh, Detroit. I don't think there were any other ties.
I think that was only one.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that was only one. So that means somebody with 10 minutes, and I don't remember if there was a field goal and a field goal and then nothing else. I don't remember how it went down. But at the end of 10 minutes, it ended up being scoreless. Basketball. You know what's perfect about basketball overtime? Is they play a condensed game, and everybody plays offense and defense, and at the end of it, you have to score more than the opponent.
And this way, you have to score more than the opponent. That's my problem with your proposal. You said it, and fundamentally, like this is like my biggest one. Oh, the ones I mentioned, those are nitpicks. But here's my big one. You said in basketball, they play a condensed game. It is still basketball. They're not doing anything different. It's not a dunk contest. It's not like, hey, you got to take threes now.
What's different about this? This isn't college.
What's different about
this?
But it is. The clock is a part of the game. Kicking the extra point or your decision, your free will, if you want to make it there, if you want to take it there, to go for two or not, it's up to you. Now you're taking this away.
In the postseason, the clock doesn't matter. It's a 15-minute quarter in the postseason, correct? In overtime. If it's tied at the end of 15 minutes, they keep playing. You got to keep playing. Right. Maybe if in a regular season you want to keep the clock, that's fine. But in the postseason, if we're going to decide who advances in the playoffs, it should not be one possession each, then sudden death. It should not be walk-off touchdown. We didn't get the ball. The coin toss decided that game. I will never let that go. The coin toss decided that game. The coin toss kept Patrick Mahomes on the sideline a couple of years ago. This way, you have to go for the win. So you failed in stopping them. Now you have to match them with a touchdown. You may not match them with a touchdown. You held them to a field goal. Now you got to outscore them when you get the ball back. So at the end of it, somebody got more points than the other one, and everybody's had the ball. This is just your initial reaction.
I'm telling you, this is a perfect example, and I love that it's this sport. This is a perfect example of moving the goalpost? It really is, because you
literally
said to each.
I'm literally
yeah, you really
moving the goalpost.
You moved the goalpost out of it, and now I got to go for two. Wait a minute. Yeah. How are you going to move the goalpost?
John Harbaugh would love this.
Yeah, he would. But he's out of. He didn't even make the playoffs because he was loving 2-point conversions too much. If you made, if you like kick some extra points, you maybe you've been in the playoffs. But Mike, you've said to each team, you get a possession. Think about mm-hmm. think about your kids. Think about what your kids would say, because you know this. You got three kids. I got three kids, and they're all about what the other two are doing. Well, you did this. Hey, you did this for her. Why not for me? Well, you let him go, mm-hmm. not for me. You gave him that much. Mm-hmm. How many? You gave him 20. Why you don't
everybody
give me 10?
Everybody gets the best deal.
Well, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like Verizon.
So
or
you're
AT&T
saying to your kids, you get a possession and you get a possession. Oh, great. We get the same thing. Well, not quite. With your possession, you don't just get the extra kick and extra point.
Okay.
You must go
but
for two.
I thought this would appeal to you. Michael, what is the argument that you made to me and a lot of people have made about why Sunday night's ending was not unfair? What have you said?
Because you get you get to make a stop.
You what?
You get to play defense.
Okay.
Play defense.
So that team that has to go for two, you could have stopped them from scoring a touchdown. You could have held them to a field goal. So, but you still have life after death, so to speak. So you give them a touchdown. You give up your touchdown. But hey, okay, we're not gonna penalize you with that with a loss. And now you got to go home wondering what if you'd got the ball. You get the ball back. But this can't go on forever. Now you got to go for the win. We're not going to just tie it and then do this all over again. Because if we have to tie it and do it all over again, when does it end? And you saying time. I'm trying to come up with something equitable and yet still exciting. It maintains the excitement level. It raises the stakes. So no different than an NBA team with down by two on the road. You're trying to tie, you're getting out of there with a win. So this makes you have to, you gave up the touchdown. All right, cool. You messed up once. The penalty for that, and you're playing a different kind of football when you have the ball second, because you're going for it on fourth down. You're probably going to be more aggressive. You're playing a different style than a team that gets it first that may be willing to say, okay, I'll kick a field goal, and, you know, I'll let my defense stop you. So if you get it first and you kick a field goal, and then I score a touchdown, you didn't stop me. And you didn't score in the first possession.
Right.
Think it through.
Okay.
Smoke a little something, drink a little something, and think it through.
Well, you mentioned life after death.
I don't mean that literally. I'm joking.
I know.
I'm joking when I say
but
smoke.
But same album. Same album. Yeah. Number four.
Never
I know
get
you
high
heard this
on your
before.
Own supply.
Never get high on your own supply. Come on, man.
Hey, I'm trying to. Hey, man. All
trying,
I'm trying to do.
But you're trying. I like the effort.
I'm trying. I'm trying to close
like
the gap between the world's problems and solutions. And what the world needs more, the world needs love. Love's in need
really
of love today.
You?
And the world needs a better overtime system in the NFL. And I am here. You're welcome.
You and Terrence did a really good job. Well, Terrence did a really good job just thinking it through. Thinking it through. But it needs a little bit more work. A little bit more.
I think you should think on this. You should consider
this. Okay. I will. I'll consider it.
Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Years since a team has won a game running that few times in the game. I mean, passing that few times. Is that embarrassing?
I mean, what kind
Boy,
of question?
What are we doing, bro?
What kind of question is that?
That's funny. We'll remember that.
This goes into this respect. It's all about respect. I come here every single week and I answer your questions truthfully, honestly. I appreciate you guys. Don't do that. Don't do that.
I think the one thing I can say to this media, because this media gets kind of up sometimes when it comes to me, we don't have our full roster. Y'all know we don't have our full roster. Stop asking me stupid questions about if I feel like I can do something. If I had my roster like they did, then I feel like I can do whatever I want to do.
Russ ended it on the bench. I was curious if you just had a reaction to that. I don't think we've seen that in a close game this year. And How was Russ after the game? Is that the sort of thing that bothers him?
Now, would you think that would bother Russ not being in the late game? You should coach yourself. You guys want to quote us all the time, coach yourself. All right. Thank you. I'm going to the movies with my wife, man. I got to go.
Regular viewers of this show know that not a week, maybe not even a day goes by when Michael and I do not quote John Sawatzky. John Sawatzky changed my life, changed my career. And I think I speak for a lot of people. I am a disciple of John Sawatzky. I have preached John Sawatzky's gospel when it comes to interviewing to Michael Holly. I have taught a class for a semester at Marist College based on John Sawatzky's principle. And John is kind enough to join us. Investigative reporter, author, instructor, and interview scientist is here to help us nerd out. So this tape should be sent to journalism classes everywhere because John is about to put some knowledge down. John, thank you so much for being here. One of our biggest arguments that Michael and I had was after that first soundbite post Bills Patriots game, when the reporter asked Jerry Sullivan, I believe it was, asked the Bills if they were embarrassed by the Patriots running over them and not throwing the ball in a win in the freezing cold. And Michael and I went at it the next day because that trigger word of embarrassed, John, triggered me. And I was like, they reacted the way they should have because that was a loaded question. Mm-hmm. Michael and others said, no, the players should have acted more professionally in response. They didn't have to go about it that way. So, John, can you explain what was wrong with that question from the reporter?
Before you answer that, John, that's a mistake, Michael Smith. You said what was wrong, and that is an opinion that you have put into a question to John Sawatzky, and that is Sawatzky 101.
My bad. That wasn't lean at all. Okay, wait, I'm sorry. Open-ended, neutral, and lean. I'm sorry. Okay. John, what did you think about Jerry Sullivan's question to Micah Hyde and Jordan Poyer?
It was an embarrassing question.
Thank you.
And Michael, your question wasn't neutral, that is true, but it was less egregious than the other Michael's question. So we're talking about degree. In fact, it's pretty hard to ask a question that is neutral. You know, just try it sometime. You know, and it's not that easy. But some of the stuff that has been going on in terms of the questions being asked have been real doozers, you know, and it just goes to show that a lot of journalists don't think about their questions. They just throw them out, you know, and they don't realize the questions contain content that people react to, you know. And when you look at it simply as a matter of like corporate goals, if you're a corporation, you're trying to get something done, you have goals and you want to get as many, clear away as many of the obstacles as you possibly can that'll disrupt those goals. Well, the same thing happens with questions. You know, we have a reason for asking a question. We want to get something when we ask a question, you know, and there's so many different ways we can screw it up, and we do, you know, and that's part of the problem. The thing about questions is that they're very powerful, you know, but they're also very fragile. They disrupt very quickly. You know, I always think of them in terms of being the peregrine falcon. The peregrine falcon is the most powerful bird in the sky. It has no flying enemies. It has all the food it wants. It's the fastest bird in the sky. And yet it almost became extinct in half of North America. You know, and they had to put it on the endangered species list. You know, why is that? Because they're very powerful, but they're also very fragile. And DDT got into its reproductive system and they couldn't, the shells on their eggs were too thin to hatch, so they couldn't reproduce. You know, questions are the same thing. They're powerful, but they're fragile. And we have to use them more precisely. As journalists, you know, we're professionals. We need to know how to ask questions professionally. And that's what I've gone around teaching journalists to do, how to ask questions professionally in a way that gets results.
I know Michael wants to ask you some open-ended, neutral and lean questions, but I really would love it if you, what's the line, John? I know the line, but I like it better when you say it. I could recite it about questions as window panes.
Oh, well, I see them as windows. I mean, what's the purpose of having a window is so you can see outside, right? And so you want clean windows, and you want windows that are free of defects, no cracks, no bubbles, you know, because the whole purpose of that window is to give you a sense of reality that is outside. And so when we ask a question, we want to get from the person, from the respondent, a picture of reality of what is going on in their life. And so we don't want to ask questions that are dirty, you know, that are biased, that have filth on them, that are cracked, you know, anything that distorts the view. We want to get a clear view about reality that is going on. Because in the end, that's what we're trying to do as journalists. We're trying to convey reality to our audience.
Now, I was going to ask you about Buffalo, but I want to move on. I was going to ask you about Jerry Sullivan and what the approach he could have used in that situation that would have elicited what he was looking for. But we'll get to it. We'll get there. I'm more interested in the next clip. You know, we had Penny Hardaway, and I think about his response, and I even think about an old clip from Dennis Green saying, "Yeah, you want to crown him? Then go ahead and crown him. The Bears are who we thought they were." And those are guys just bringing emotion, and yes, the questions weren't necessarily great, but I guess the counter to the clean windows is, well, maybe the question wasn't great, but the content is so memorable that we're still talking about it. Aren't we still trying to get to that content, even though it wasn't delivered via a clean question?
You make a really good point. And here's the thing. I mean, there's no rules, you know, but there are principles. And these principles, they're universal and they're timeless, you know. But there always are exceptions, you know. And it's like anything else. You know, I come from an economics background, and where the law of supply, you know, I learned the law of supply in my first lecture I ever took in university. And the law of supply, the law of supply and demand absolutely applies, but there are exceptions. And sometimes when you increase the price of something, it goes up. The demand goes up rather than down. And that is true. There's always exceptions, but if you follow those exceptions and use that as your guide, you're going to run into trouble. And that's the same thing with interviewing. So once in a while, you'll throw a trigger word in there and it'll get them to react and they'll supply emotion and it'll be a great clip. You know, playoffs? You think playoffs? You know, we're just lucky to win a game, you know, and we've all heard that one often enough. And but those are exceptions. And if you devise an interview methodology based on exceptions, you're going to be a bad interviewer, you know. And you're going to get into the case that some programs get into, where they interview, I call it interviewing by exception. They ask bad question after bad question after bad question, and they keep taping, till they get enough exceptions, they can string together a series of answers that can get onto the air, you know. It's a very inefficient, bad way to conduct an interview. So rather than interview by exception, you should interview by example.
Yeah, no, one of the things I'm fond of saying when it comes to, because people will say, you know, well, and Michael and I talked about that. Well, you know, they got a great response, or they got what they were looking for. I'm like, is the reason why people don't realize that they don't know how to interview is because they don't know what they could have gotten had they asked a more effective question. Like, you think you got something good.
Yes.
Yes.
What is the opportunity cost? You know, and some of my most effective sessions I've had, you know, when I was working at ESPN, was after I sit down, Michael, you took my course for 3 days. And then at the end of it, I'd sit down individually with people and go over their tape. And so often they'd say, and I'd show, okay, here's what you gave up. If you asked the question this way, look at the possibilities you would have had. And they go, oh, man. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I see it. Now the penny drops. You say, you have to, what did you give up in order to get that? That's the bottom line.
Ooh, John, I'm going to put you on the spot now. Present company excluded. Present company excluded in the sports realm and outside of sports. Who do you think? Who are some of your favorite interviewers working today? Just give us
present
like three or
excluded.
Four.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate that question. If there's any question.
I know. It's so unfair, isn't it?
It's because most people interview badly, you know, and most journalists are bad interviewers, you know, and that's because.
That hurts, but you know, it's true. It's true.
When you're talking about communication, there's two elements to it. There's output and there's input, right? Those are the only two things when you communicate with somebody, whether it's through an interview or a conversation or anything else, it's always intake and output and input, you know? And of course, in journalism, we've all focused on the outputting skills. And those are, you have to be a good outputter to get on television. You have to, you know, and those are the people who tend to rise to the top, but those are also the people who do the worst interviews, because interviewing is not about giving, it's about getting, you see, and all the principles are reversed. All your instincts are exactly the opposite, you know, and it's like being a basketball player and learning only offense and not defense, you know. It's like being a baseball player and learning only how to hit and never working on your glove skills, you know, fielding skills. And you're going to be a one-way player and you'll never be a superstar. You need to be a star in both dimensions, output and input. Just like in sports, you have to be a star in offense and defense. Yep.
Yeah. Now, I'm telling you, because I took your seminar in 2006. I think it was 2006. And by that time, you know, I'm young, hotshot. You couldn't tell me. I didn't know how to interview. And then I took your class. I was like, oh, my God. But it's like with so many people have just been doing it for a certain way for so long, and it works. They don't know to do any better. But what I'm curious about, John, I know you always talk about how your methodology is constantly evolving. You're constantly learning yourself. Even since I first met you, and we've kept in touch over the years, and I first took your class, and you know, my paradigm shifted from learning from you, the landscape of media has changed. There are so many podcasts, and podcasts being hosted by non-traditional journalists. I mean, a lot of athletes, a lot of celebrities, a lot of influencers, if you will, are in media now. The formats have changed. The platforms have evolved and changed from the days when we were discussing sideline reporting or your traditional sit down interview, one-on-one, those type or, you know, exclusive interviews, that sort of thing. There's so many different, opportunities for interaction. What do you think, of let me see if I can phrase this differently. Trying to make sure I ask this the right way. Since I'm in front of you, I want to get it right. Pressure, I got to get it right. Since I'm in front of you, how would you adapt your principles to fit the changing media landscape?
Well, the principles don't change. They're timeless. You know, you're still trying to do basically the same thing. Your storytelling. You know, if you're in journalism, essentially, you're into storytelling. Even people on breaking news, the hard news reporters, you know, their things change a little bit. But your storytelling, and it becomes a matter of how do you get that story across to your audience? You know, who is the storyteller? And, you know, who's the storyteller talking to? Are you the storyteller talking to your audience? Or are you interviewing somebody when the person you're interviewing becomes a storyteller and they're talking to you, you know? And that's where the application changes. But in terms of, because somebody is new in a new podcast or something, that doesn't change at all. In fact, they have a bit of an advantage because they haven't learned all the bad skills that professional journalists have picked up, you know? I remember many, many, many years ago when I started as a newspaper reporter, some of the best interviews I ever did were some of the first interviews I ever did, you know? And then what happened, I became skillful And after a while, my interviews weren't as effective as they were at the beginning, you know, this rookie luck thing. And that's not a coincidence. You see, what happens is I learned more. And I got opinionated, you know, and I started jumping to conclusions, you see. And rather than starting at the beginning, you know, and finding out what really was going on, I'd make certain leaps and certain assumptions. And I knew so much, I didn't have to ask what some people would regard as a dumb question. Well, why is that?
Right.
You know, those very simple questions.
Those are the best questions.
Those are the best questions.
Yeah.
And those are the basic ones that get out the essential story, you know. Yeah. And I was actually jumping ahead of that process, and I was screwing up the process, you know. Yeah. So some of the people that are not traditional journalists that are in podcasts, they can be doing some actually pretty good stuff because they haven't learned enough to screw it up yet.
I love it.
Yeah. My final question for you, John, is how do Mike and I get better as interviewers?
Well, you know, in sports, what do coaches and athletes do? They study tape, right? They study tape. You know, I was just reading a feature on Cooper Kupp, you know, who you could argue should be the MVP of the year. You know, he's not the fastest.
Okay, John, with the take. Okay, John, with the sports take. Okay.
Like it.
I appreciate it. Slide that in there.
And this is coming from a Seahawks fan who is not a Rams fan. But I have to give Cooper Kupp his due, you know. He's not the fastest. He's not the biggest, you know. But he's the guy who always does it in the end, you see. And what does he do? He studies tape. You know, he keeps the and this is the thing we have to do. Go back and study the questions. You know what was interesting? When I used to teach a lot in Europe, and these are all in the Nordic countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, these countries, you know, Netherlands, none of them operated in English, although they all spoke English very well. And of course, I was teaching them in English, and I was teaching them off their tape, which was in Swedish or Norwegian or something. And I would have them when we did tape analysis session. Of course, I don't know a word of Swedish, and they would play the tape and stop it and translate. And then they'd play another sentence and translate for me. You know what? And half the time I didn't have to say anything. They'd play a sentence, they'd translate, they'd say, oh, okay, I know what the problem is. You don't have to say anything, you know.
Yeah.
And because forcing them to go through that, they realize, oh, well, this is, you know, like we're running at full speed, you know, not slow-mo. And when we're looking at ourselves, and this was slowing them down, and they were looking at every word, and it became obvious what the problem was, you know.
Yeah.
So I just give you my Cooper Kupp example. Just go back and study tape. You know.
Study the tape.
Yeah. Hey, John, this has been fantastic.
I'll get my take in there.
this has been fantastic. Again, it feels full circle. I mean, people who listen to us, hear us name drop you all the time. I got to make a confession on the way out. I break your rules all the time, but I know I'm breaking them. I'm just getting a little too much into my output, but I know what I'm doing. Yeah. I haven't forgotten them. I'm in output mode as much as input mode. But when I want to, I lock in. And for those that don't know, they're also good with your significant others, and they're good for applicants and job interviews. They're good in every walk of life. It's not just journalism.
Absolutely. Oh, no,
they're great.
This has universal application.
Yeah. Universal application. God bless you, John. Thank you so much for everything.
There
man.
It is.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a blast.
All right,
take care.
You know, every year I just have to make sure that I'm have the ability to commit to what the team really needs. And that's really important to me. The team doesn't deserve anything less than my best. And if I feel like I'm not committed to that, or I can't play at a championship level, then you got to give someone else a chance to play. And, you know, we'll see, you know, again, there's a long time between now and the start of next football season. And, you know, I've got to really figure those things out, which is probably natural for anyone. And at the same time, I would say this. We never know what's going to happen in the future. We really don't. I mean, Kobe Bryant, a friend of ours, God rest his soul. You know, you think you're going to live forever. We're not. We think we're going to play forever. We're not. What can we do? We can enjoy the moments that we have.
All right. So, Mike, you know, Tom Brady talking about what everybody is asking, you know, what's going to happen with your career? Are you going to return to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers for your third season with Tampa? And the fact that we're even having this conversation just takes me back to what I said there, right? You know, which number 12 knows what he's doing next? I think Tom Brady knows. I know what he's saying. Hey, you know, tomorrow's not promised. The season just ended. We're going to take our time and all this. This is different. I haven't heard him say it like this at the end of the year. And I'm going to explain it this way. I've heard Tom Brady talk about his family, how his wife is his number one supporter. I've heard him talk about how, you know, life is precious and you just don't know and you can't overreact. I've heard all that. But generally what he says is some version of, why would I stop playing football now? So he told Peter King 8 years ago now, I've got the answers to the test. Why would I stop now?
Yeah.
In 2013, roundabout, or 13 or 14, he said, why does everybody want me to retire? When I suck, I'll retire. I'm a football player. This is what I love to do. I love being in that locker room. I love competing. He usually says all of those things. I want to play till 45. And then when I get to 45, we'll see if I'll keep going. But no, he's not. And it's not because the season just ended. I think this is the moment. I don't know what he's going to do. I'm not telling you like, hey, I got the inside story. But I know from watching and interviewing and listening to Tom Brady all these years, this, I think, is the most seriously he's considered retiring. I don't think he's ever been this far along.
I don't think that's a stretch I don't think that's a stretch and take this the right way. I don't think that's that bold of a statement. And the only reason I say that is,
and I'm not trying to be bold. I'm just trying to tell you.
No. But I'm saying it's kind of obvious. But it's kind of obvious. He's never been 44. Like it would shock me if he weren't thinking about the end.
But it's not 44. It's not the numbers because you know 44. I mean, just 44.
No. I'm
the beginning of this year.
He's played so long. He shouldn't. Why would he be thinking the way he thought 7 or 8 years ago or 10 years ago at this stage of his life and his family's life? Or 3 years ago or a year ago?
This year. This year. Something changed with Tom Brady. See, 44, just so we're clear on this.
I'm saying
44 was never.
That's what's changed.
Well, I don't know.
Like, Michael, you think differently than you did 3 years ago. I'm saying this was inevitable.
Unfortunately,
at some point, Tom Brady was going to think about retirement. I hear you. It sounds like he's leaning that way. So I get why you would say you think he knows. I doubt it. And the only reason I tend to doubt that he knows.
But, Mike, 44 was never something. It was not. Tom Brady was not a year by year. We'll look at it at the end of the year. At the beginning of the 2021 season, it's like, what? Oh, yeah, 45, 48.
So maybe he
this
was
is
just.
A change in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
But I'm agreeing with you. Changed. I don't know. Okay, maybe something happened behind the scenes that we don't know. He's a very private person, as open as he's gotten since he's gotten to Tampa. He's a very private person. We're not privy to whatever conversation he's had behind closed doors with Giselle or the kids. So maybe something has changed. What I'm saying is, just like when you get older, you got to take certain vitamin supplements. You got to visit the doctor more often. You have to think about the end when you didn't think about the end and you thought you'd live forever. This is the natural progression for somebody's career. An unprecedented career. Most people don't have to wrestle with this decision after 22 years. Most people are long into retirement because either they've gotten tired of it or the game has retired them. It would shock me if he weren't wrestling with this. I think he's agonizing over it. I don't think he knows. I think it gets harder and harder for him to muster up the sacrifice that it takes to play at the level of commitment that he needs to and the level of excellence that he needs to. So he may be kind of nudging closer to retirement than he was before, and therefore talking more openly about it. I don't know that he knows, because what was what also surprised me about Tom Brady is if at any point this year to do what he did with one toe or foot out the door because you're thinking about it, and not only are you thinking about it, you know this is the end.
Well,
that would surprise me given how laser focused he's always been on the task at hand. I think I take him at his word that right now is when he's going to assess what to do. Right now. And he's just letting us in on his process.
Hold on. He's a multitasker.
Michael, you know what they say when you start talking? When you're getting divorced, you've been getting you take your marriage and divide it by two. When you start talking about divorce, you've been thinking about it much longer than that. I don't believe that the Tom Brady that I think I know, I think Tom Brady was focused on this season. And I don't think he knew that he was done. I don't think he knew.
He may
come to this place of being done, but I don't think he knew. And I don't think he knows now. I think he's agonizing over it. And I'll just make this real quick point. One thing that I think will factor in, and I think we underrated the last couple of days, is that the Bucks probably have to do some kind of a recruiting job to make it harder for him to walk away. I think we got it backwards. Like, oh, well, he got to let them know so they can decide on Godwin and Fournette and Jensen and Gronkowski maybe, or Carlton Davis or Jordan Whitehead. You know, maybe they got to make those decisions so that Giselle don't have to watch him get hit. You were saying?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you can decide to retire and still be focused on the job. I mean, how many great athletes have gone into a season saying, this is it.
We just talked about Kobe.
And they win a championship.
The farewell tour.
And they win
championship. Absolutely.
Or win a championship. Like John Elway.
I'm not saying it's impossible.
John Elway.
I'm not saying
Kareem.
It's impossible. Like, I'm saying Brady. I'm strictly talking about Brady. People have had farewell tours, which he doesn't want.
Brady can do
I'm
it
talking
too.
About how Brady approaches his job. But he hasn't approached his job that way. You tell me this. You know this much better than me. Okay.
All right.
Because the equivalent is his last year in New England. Okay? Maybe maybe that's the evidence to your point. I'll contradict my own point. He knew it was probably the end then, but did he already know where he was going or how it was going to end? And he did multitask this year. I just give him more credit than that. I think he actually focused because like he said, the team deserves my undivided attention.
Look, sure. And as a football, but you know, it's okay for these people to say, these athletes, oh, they deserve my attention. Yes, your attention, but you're still a human being. You're a multidimensional human being. I'm giving you credit for that. Maybe the way you frame it and the way people receive it, it's less than. I don't believe that Tom Brady can only focus on football during the season and nothing else, such as his future and life after football. You can think about life after football and still play at an MVP level. He did it. We're going to find out he did it. Because if you're asking me today, I think he's saying goodbye.
I think he may have thought about it. Here's where I'll meet you. I think he's thought about it. I don't think he's fully evaluated it and come to a decision. That's the nuance. That's the subtle disagreement we have.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.